We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. By the time the 13 United States of America declared their independence from Great Britain on July 4, 1776, the two powers had been at war for more than a year, and there was no going back. But were there efforts by both sides to avoid that war? As British citizens all, couldn't they have worked things out? How necessary was the American Revolution? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. My guest is Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy, the director of the Robert H. Smith International Center for Jefferson Studies at Monticello, a professor of history at the University of Virginia and the author of many books, including The Men Who Lost America, Empire Divided, and The Illimitable Freedom of the Human Mind, Thomas Jefferson's Idea of a University. And welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman. I'm delighted to join you.
Well, the question that we posed at the beginning there was the revolution really necessary? Of course, it was not a revolution of all the colonies. There were how many colonies altogether?
Well, there were 26 in just British America. These included colonies in the Caribbean, East and West Florida, which were not part of the 13 colonies, and also Canada, which then was a series of colonies, Quebec, Nova Scotia, Montreal.
Well, there are something like, 26 complaints specifically in the Declaration of Independence of things that the signers of the Declaration were addressing to King George III. Did they apply just to those 13 colonies?
For the most part, they did. Jefferson, of course, wrote the first draft of the Declaration. And unlike the many other declarations of independence by individual colonies and even towns, he included really an exhaustive list of every grievance of the colonies to demonstrate that there was a state of tyranny in America to justify a rebellion. And some of these complaints went back far beyond the beginning of George III's reign. In his original draft, he accused George III of being responsible for bringing enslaved people to America. This, of course, had begun back in 1619 in Virginia. And he was essentially also including many individual grievances of specific colonies, but the idea was to be exhaustive and to prove that there was a state of tyranny in America.
Was there any attempt by the Crown to divide and conquer those 13 colonies by offering benefits to some of the colonies and not the others?
To a degree. They really tried to isolate Boston from the other colonies and Massachusetts. They saw Massachusetts as really the heart of the rebellion, which is why they focused on trying to cut it off in the beginning, and also to offer some sort of peace negotiations. And there were several conducted during the war. At the very height of the war, the Carlisle Commission in 1778 offered really to remove all of the offending British policies in return for just token acknowledgement of British sovereignty. They also exempted the British Caribbean from some of the policies that they pursued in America.
Now, some of the ones that we're most familiar with that at least symbolically sparked the revolution, see, I think 1773, the Boston Tea Party, which was, of course, protesting a tax on tea.
And this should have been an indication to the British that the colonies were united. It's easy to see why they thought that Massachusetts was the sort of pioneer and the leader of the rebellion. But the fact is that there were equivalent of tea parties in most of the other colonies, including New York, and places like Virginia stopped the tea from being landed and prevented it from being distributed. There was no similar problem in the British Caribbean, places like Jamaica, even though they shared the objection of the mainland colonists to this imposition of direct taxes from Britain. And my very first book, which I wrote incidentally in Wisconsin, was called An Empire Divided, The American Revolution and British Caribbean, which really tries to explain why those colonies remained loyal and why, even though they objected to a lot of British policies and shared many of the same ideas as the American colonies, they did not rebel.
How big a tax was that tea tax?
So the tea tax was actually very small, and Lord North, who was Prime Minister of Britain at the time, simply could not understand why Americans objected so much to it. He pointed out that Americans paid about 1/50th of the taxes of the British. That's almost certainly an exaggeration, that on average, they were very much more prosperous, the standard of living was higher. And he saw it essentially as a token tax that would be so small that it would establish the principle that the British Parliament had the right to tax America, but that actually ironically reduced the cost of British tea, which was exempt from duties in Britain. And that would be an incentive for the Americans to import British tea. They had largely been importing foreign tea, Dutch tea especially, at a much cheaper price.
And what about before that, I think 1764, the Stamp Act, was that also in effect a form of taxation?
Yes, actually the first tax was 1764, revenue or sugar tax, that Americans were ambivalent about because it could simply be seen as a trade regulation. But really the first major tax was the Stamp Act tax. That was certainly heavier, but it would have done nothing to reduce the British national debt, which was the main obsession with the British. They were very concerned about the cost of the empire and policing it and defending it, and felt that the American colonies should share in that burden. And so this is why they imposed it. It really represented a departure from previous British policy in that it was claiming that Parliament had the right to tax America directly. And this was novel, and you could see it as really the primary cause of the American Revolution. The major waves of resistance all coincided with new taxes. So there's the Stamp Act tax in 1765, what were called the Townshend Revenue taxes of 1767, which were on a very odd variety of goods, including glass, for example, imported from Britain. And then finally, the Tea Act of 1773. It should be said that the British backed down. They withdrew the Stamp Act in 1766. They removed nearly all of the Townshend duties in 1770, except for the tax on tea. And that was another reason Lord North thought there would be no objection to is basically reducing the duties on tea with the Tea Act in 1773, which was designed to help the East India Company that was basically going bankrupt. This was a company that essentially ruled India. It had its own army, its own navy, and was overseeing a vast territory. And he could never understand why it caused such objection, because Americans had essentially been paying some duties on tea for 3 years.
Was there any sense that or explanation offered that, well, after all, it costs money to run the colonies, to defend them, and this is your tax dollars at work?
That's correct. The reason that it was so resented in America is you had this, what is often called a Republican philosophy, that was paranoid about the expansion of central government, distrustful of government. And that's partly because Americans were at such a distance from Britain and felt so vulnerable. They were very aware that they didn't have real checks and balances, real protection. And so this change in policy really changed the relationship with Britain. For much of the 1760s, the Americans were the most enthusiastic imperialists, and they wanted to expand the British Empire and move west. And this changed the dynamics completely of the relationship.
Were there inequalities then between British American citizens and British citizens? I seem to recall, at least in the army, there was some inequality between the army in Britain and the colonial armies. But were there other things that were quite clearly inequalities between the colonies and the home?
So Americans often felt that they were being treated in a patronizing manner, and not as equals. You could say that behind most imperial policies is a sort of metropolitan hubris and condescension towards colonies. George Washington originally had thought about joining the British Army, and his brother had wanted and had fought for a while with the British Navy. But those were often not options for people living in the colonies. The governorships, for the most part, and the most remunerative of positions would go to people from Britain.
And were there efforts other than, you know, writing angry letters, I assume, that crossed the Atlantic? Was there actually representation by colonists going to England? I seem to recall also that Benjamin Franklin made some efforts in that regard before the war.
So they had lobbyists, and many of the colonies had their own lobbyists at the beginning of the 1760s. By 1774, Franklin almost alone was the main lobbyist for all of the major colonies. And one of the turning points for him was when he was humiliated by the Privy Council, who cross-examined him and really made him the folk guy for American resistance. And he was wearing a brown coat during this cross-examination. And when the British finally signed the peace terms in 1783, he wore the same brown coat, and you can see it in a painting by John Singleton Copley, in which only the American delegates to the peace are portrayed. It does not include the British delegates, who, for reasons I think we can understand, didn't want to be included in the painting.
Well, it's one thing to have policies, taxes, even a patronizing attitude that would stir some resentment among the American colonies, the 13 colonies. But what become the flashpoints then? I mean, something has to set this off other than just money, right?
Yes. So taxes I see as the main flashpoints. It's in resistance to the Stamp Act and the Townshend duties that the colonies start to create committees that communicate with one another. In the Stamp Act resistance, they even created a Stamp Act Congress for the first time that met in New York. And of course, later, another Congress would meet in 1775. But of course, there were many issues that led to the American Revolution, some very specific to individual colonies. We can think, for example, of the policy of having the British forces in America after the French and Indian War. So the British planned to keep 10,000 troops. Originally, they were to be on the border, but people suspected that they were going to be used against Americans. And indeed, some of them were moved to Boston and New York. There were issues regarding Western expansion. The British were very worried about another Indian rebellion in the West. They wanted to contain expansion with what was called the Western Proclamation. The British also wanted to increase their revenues from customs, and they strengthened the system of obtaining customs. And there are even religious issues. There'd been talk about having an Anglican bishop in America, which made people fear that there might be an establishment of religion throughout all of the colonies.
I'm starting to hear pre-echoes of the Bill of Rights in some of these things. I assume the quartering of troops was part of the issue you talked about in terms of the 10,000 troops there after the French and Indian War. They would have, in some instances, apparently have been quartered coercively in American homes.
Well, that is one myth. In actual fact, they were to be quartered in empty buildings and municipal buildings, not in private homes. But of course, that became the perceived wisdom. One of the difficulties about writing about the causes of the American Revolution, especially teaching it in schools and at universities, is that it just becomes a long list of all these provocative British policies that then often make little sense to us as to why they embarked on that. It's also part of our myth as a nation. Here in America, it's difficult to look at it independently and to look at the British perspective. What they were basically trying to do, and you can see this in their policies throughout the empire, was to create a stronger central government. They were very fearful that the empire would just be dismantled. They wanted to get a revenue from the empire. They wanted to strengthen its defenses and to make it much more viable. And the French and the Spanish, who'd always had a much more authoritarian system of government, they were doing much the same thing in their colonies at the time. But this new authoritarianism, this attempt to centralize and to tax, this is really what Americans feared. But it is worth pointing out, one of the questions I like to ask to students is, was there real tyranny in America in 1774 and 1776? It is worth pointing out the British backed down on most of these policies in response to resistance. But they finally came to the conclusion that it was because they backed down that they were actually encouraging the colonies to be more independent. And that is the moment where they really start to think in terms of coercion. The Tea Party in Boston and the desire to punish Boston and New England, that becomes what I would call the trigger cause of the war. And by stripping Massachusetts of its charter and its traditional method of government, putting in a military governor, removing the right to elect their own council, and by trying to isolate Massachusetts, they actually, it has the opposite effect. A lot of Americans were very sympathetic to the idea that the Tea Party had literally gone overboard, that this was an attack on private property. It was wrong. Franklin was even talking about reimbursing the British. But by using such coercive methods, and of course having the army stationed in Boston, that then became the green light for the rest of the colonies to group in support of Massachusetts and New England, because they feared if this could happen to Massachusetts, it could happen anywhere, and that central government was overreaching itself.
We're going to see where exactly the tipping point, the point of no return, came from in the American Revolution when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy, and we're asking the question, was the American Revolution necessary? And we've already learned that many of the events, acts on the part of the British government that made the Americans restless, let's say, were actually revoked. These various taxes and other acts revoked by the British as a conciliatory means. And yet, as we know, things proceeded badly. So at what point did revolution become inevitable, Andrew?
Well, Mary Beth Norton just won the George Washington Prize for a book called 1774. And she argues this was the point of no return. She makes an excellent case. It was in 1774 that the British passed the Coercive Acts to punish Massachusetts and New England for the Boston Tea Party. The first act closed the port of Boston. And of course, the port there was the lifeline of the town of Boston. And they also had a Massachusetts Charter Act, changing the Charter of Massachusetts. And by this point, there was considerable suspicion of the British throughout the colonies, suspicion of almost paranoia that they're attempting to destroy the liberties and quasi-independence that the colonies had enjoyed. And the colonies had also had experience of forming intergovernmental committees to communicate with each other. Inside the colonies, people who were calling themselves patriots were gaining control of the courts, the militia, and the local assemblies. Governors, British governors, were finding themselves almost powerless. And it's from that point that you really get the momentum towards war. The decision to create a Congress that meets at the beginning of the end of 1774 and again in 1775. And actual fighting breaks out in April of 1775 with Lexington, Concord, and then the Battle of Bunker Hill. And that's significant because it reminds us that almost a year before the American Revolution, there was a war between Britain and America. and that the Americans at that point were not trying to claim independence. People like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson denied that they'd even thought about independence before 1775. And they saw it as a war of grievances. They even, when they took Fort Ticonderoga, they even labeled everything they captured with the idea that it might at some point be restored to Britain. So although 1774 is the turning point, and it's also the first year in which you have people called loyalists, Americans who supported Britain, they still were not committing themselves to the idea of independence. There were other policies, not least the war itself, that helped to push them over the edge and to declare independence. They also needed foreign assistance. That was going to be terribly important in winning the war against Britain. I'm interested in looking at the war as a counter-insurrectionary war, much like we just fought in Afghanistan and Vietnam. And sometimes smaller powers succeed against some of the strongest countries in the world simply by the extent of support for their rebellion, but also because they're getting outside help, which may indeed be the case in Ukraine.
Well, yes, we get into these parallel situations, don't we? And of course, France had plenty of reasons to oppose the British through their surrogate, the American colonies, having just already fought a war with them, the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, and of course, a long history of enmity between those two countries, going back probably to William the Conqueror, even. So there was the advantage that the Americans had, although I think maybe did it take the French a little while to actually sign on to substantial assistance for the Americans?
Well, they didn't become allies of the Americans until halfway through the war in 1778. But secretly, they were sending Americans supplies. The man who wrote the libretto to Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, Beaumarchais, he created a company called Hortlitz and Company that would smuggle weapons, uniforms, and most essentially gunpowder to America. The gunpowder was a real issue because Americans did not produce their own saltpeter and did not make gunpowder. This all had to be imported. So from the very start, the French were important. The British also did not fully mobilize their army and navy because they didn't want to provoke France to come into the war. And that would be very significant that they were so slow to fully mobilize all of their forces. Of course, they never thought that they would need to have a huge army and navy. They imagined that they were going to win this war very easily and very quickly. They also believed, and this was really the most crucial error on the part of Britain, they believed the majority of Americans supported them. And this is partly because probably one-fifth of the population were Tories or loyalists. They did support them, but they were much better at giving the impression that they were in a majority. And so throughout the war, the British were always on this holy grail, trying to find the colony where the majority of Americans would support them.
It has been described sometimes, the Revolution, as also a civil war. Would that be exaggerating the amount of support for the crown in the American colonies?
No, it's very important to see it also as a civil war, America's first civil war. Some 19,000 Americans fought for the British. You may have seen the Mel Gibson movie, The Patriot.
Yes.
And he portrays Bannister Tarleton, who's the most hated of the British officers. But what he doesn't show is that Tarleton commanded a cavalry entirely composed of Americans. And some of the battles were largely fought between Americans with very few British present, especially in the South. And it is also true of most revolutions that they become civil wars. This happened in the Arab Spring. It happens constantly. We are often excited when a revolution against an autocratic power breaks out, but all too often it becomes a civil war. And that is because some Americans believe that there was not a state of British tyranny, that it would be possible to resolve the issues with Britain. They were distrustful of the patriots. They regarded them as the real tyrants. It's worth remembering that if you were a loyalist, you could have your land stripped from you, be tarred and feathered, removed from any offices. And there was not really a free press. And so loyalists resented all of this and persuaded themselves that the real tyranny were the patriots, which is what the British believed as well.
It seems, as again often happens in these cases, that the greater power has one big disadvantage, and that is just the sheer distance from the war.
It's very important. And they simply couldn't comprehend the size of America. And the intelligence, especially in the last stages of the war, was often poor. British ministers were looking at maps, which of course didn't give a good sense of the navigability of rivers, the flow of rivers, weather patterns. So when, for example, John Burgoyne marched down from Canada and took Fort Ticonderoga, he thought it would be a cakewalk to get to Albany. And really his problems started there. It was very difficult terrain. He was relying and thought that he would get almost unanimous support in upstate New York, which had a lot of loyalists. But he described how people appeared from nowhere, the Hampshire Grants, what is now New Hampshire, and places like Vermont that didn't exist then as a state, to fight against the British. He arrived across the border with twice as many troops as the Continental Army. By the time he got to Saratoga, which we regard as the turning point of the war in 1777, and that did indeed induce the French to ally with America, by the time he got there, he was outnumbered 4-1. And he later said, that it had been unimaginable to him that the troops would be so good who fought against him. He said that the American troops were as good as any European troops. And he marveled at the way that they'd managed to train their army and to make it a real rival to the British.
Well, that Battle of Saratoga in 1777 really did have a lot of shots that rang around the world. Even Mozart referred to that battle, a victory for the Americans, in a letter that he wrote to his family in 1777.
This is what persuaded the world that the British could be defeated. Even though they'd had to give up Boston, it did seem at different periods of the war that they might win. It was never just a linear war of a series of defeats. As late as 1780, they took the South, they took Charleston, Cornwallis defeated the Continental Army in the South. So there was really no major force, professional force in the South. That was the year as well that Benedict Arnold went over to the British. The British were doing well in fighting the French and nearly defeated the French Navy. So they always had this sense that they could still win, but Saratoga persuaded the other European powers either to start allying with Americans or with each other. In 1780, there was a league of armed neutrality among most of the states of Europe. This is one of the only wars in British history in which the British had no real ally. They won most of their wars, including the French and Indian War, with continental allies that helped to compensate for the fact that they were a small country with a small army relative to the other major powers of Europe.
Well, as we get to this turning point in 1777, the Battle of Saratoga in particular, what do the British start to think at home? Because we're now a good 2 years into this war, which was supposed to last a very short time. And as we've seen historically in other analogous situations, things get restless on the home front. What was going on in the thinking of the British in government and in the population at this point in 2 years into the war?
So there'd been a lot of opposition to this war from the very beginning. In fact, there were more anti-war petitions from British towns that had never previously petitioned Parliament than in any previous war. And in Parliament, some of the most brilliant of the statesmen and speakers opposed this war. Charles James Fox was who later became a sort of major figure in British politics. He made his reputation opposing the war. Edmund Burke, who's sometimes called the father of conservatism, he spoke against the war in brilliant speeches. These we still teach as examples of oratory and speech. William Pitt, both the elder and the younger, spoke against the government. The parliamentary debates for this period are marvelous. Edward Gibbon, the historian who wrote The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, he said that sitting in Parliament during this period was really his education as a historian and gave him real insight into policy making and waging war.
Well, let's look further at any kind of efforts at reconciliation that the British might have offered once they were 2 years into this war, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy, and we're looking at the American Revolution. How necessary was it, really? Of course, once it got started, once the bullets started flying, it would have been much harder for any kind of peace initiative to form, regardless of who started it. However, were there efforts as the shooting started, let's say at Lexington, Concord, or Bunker Hill, efforts on the part of the British to avoid a full-scale Revolutionary War?
Well, the efforts began even before the firing and the first shots at Lexington and Concord. The British Prime Minister, Lord North, had concluded late in 1774 that the Americans were much more united than he thought. And he seems to have been one of the first to really fear that the British might lose this war. So early in 1775, he put forward something called the Conciliatory Propositions, which would basically allow Americans to come up with their own payments of taxes to make voluntarily, although the British were still to give them the amounts that were to be raised, but they would be able to use their own assemblies to raise these taxes. And about the same time, it seems he was possibly behind an approach to Benjamin Franklin made by the sister of the Howe brothers, who were the two British commanders after Bunker Hill, who commanded for the first half of the war. And she joined Franklin for a game of chess and asked him to come up with ideas as to what would be acceptable to Americans. But by the middle of the war, Lord North, as I mentioned earlier in the program, sent over the Carlisle Commission that basically conceded everything other than token British sovereignty of America. And he really wanted to end the war in America and focus on the war against the French. He would continue right up to the very end to use intermediaries to try and approach Congress and individual political leaders to discuss ways that the war might be ended. And so he always insisted later in life that it had never been his intention to pursue a war, and that he'd always tried to find some sort of medium.
Did he have the blessing of the king and others in power in that effort?
Not really. You know, Carlisle, the Earl of Carlisle, who led the commission, that struck him that even before he left for America, even North had lost interest because the king was so opposed to this policy. And he said when he parted from Lord North, it was as though he was just going to the bathroom. there was no ceremony, and they were taking very little interest in him. And George III wasn't responsible for the policies that led to the war. But after the Boston Tea Party, he became the real war hawk. And that made negotiations very difficult. He was not willing to let North resign and to negotiate with opposition leaders who were committed to a peace and even withdrawal from America.
From the British standpoint, from what you've said so far, Andrew, it seems as if they could say, well, look, we tried the carrot and you just became even more unruly, you Americans. And so we must then try the stick. And of course, the more unruly you become, the more we must use the stick.
Absolutely. I think George III put it very well. You know, after Lexington Concord, he said, they will be lions while we are sheep. And what the British were insistent upon was that the Americans recognize that Parliament had sovereign power. And this was really the issue with the taxes, parliamentary sovereignty. They felt there had to be some ultimate source of authority in the empire. They could never accept this idea of checks and balances and a division of power. They didn't believe that that could work. There had to be some form of absolute authority, even though they're willing to limit what powers Parliament would exercise. So in 1778, they promised never to try and tax America again. It might be a popular offer these days.
Yes.
To have a central government that wasn't taxing you.
It would be tempting. Were the British concerned that these ideas of representative government, somewhat autonomous from Parliament, were they concerned that these ideas might catch on in other colonies, other British colonies, if the Americans got away with too much?
They were, and indeed they were worried what effect it would have on the world, that it was opening a Pandora's box. Remember, not even the Patriots believed in the idea of pure democracy at this time. And yet everybody could see that this you know, this is where it might lead to a much more democratic system of government.
In terms of sheer wealth, what did the British stand to lose if they lost the American colonies?
Well, George III again articulates the danger for Britain better than his ministers. He said that Britain would cease to be a great power if it lost America, that it's standing not only among its colonies, but in Europe, would be irretrievably changed. That, of course, did not happen, not least because of British expansion in India and elsewhere in the world. By the time that George III died, Britain governed a fifth of the world's population by expanding elsewhere. The empire was actually bigger. And even before the war, someone coined the phrase, the empire upon which the sun never set.
And an Indian friend of mine said that's because God doesn't trust the British in the dark.
Great saying.
but I think a swap of India for the colonies, or, you know, getting India as instead of troubling with the American colonies at the time, must have seemed like a really good idea.
That's right. And when you mention Native Americans, that, of course, was another really short-term cause of people supporting the Patriots, was the fact that the British allied with Native Americans, with German mercenaries, and indeed had an ad hoc policy of freeing the slaves of those in rebellion against them, but not, of course, the enslaved people of the Tories. But that certainly helped to alienate planters and whites in the South.
That's fascinating because, of course, it's an exact parallel to what Lincoln did with the Emancipation Proclamation. He was freeing just the slaves in those territories in rebellion.
Absolutely. And the British were always ambivalent because they were not emancipators. They had 400,000 enslaved people down in the British Caribbean in places like Jamaica. But the fact is that the American Revolution was the period of greatest emancipation up until the Civil War. Many enslaved people on both sides, some of those who fought for the Continental Army or simply had run away, managed to get their freedom, although, of course, the majority of the African-American population remained enslaved.
Well, that is something we could talk about for an hour also. Is it not true that the slaves in Yorktown, when Cornwallis was bottled up in there, were actually fighting with the British against the Americans, thinking that that would be their best chance at freedom?
That's right. Although African-Americans joined both sides, many more went over to the British, who were offering them freedom if their masters were patriots. And that policy became more enshrined later on in the war. They were generally used as auxiliaries, not actually fighting directly, although in South Carolina, there are certainly examples of African-Americans actually engaged directly in battle. And it led the British ultimately to create the largest slave army in the world down in the Caribbean, in which they started to arm and in fact import enslaved people from Africa and to turn them into an army to defend their colonies in the British Caribbean.
My 11th grade history teacher said at one time, the British did not lose the American Revolution, they just stopped fighting.
That is a very good summary. They still held St. Augustine. They still held parts of Georgia, Charleston, South Carolina, New York. Their army in Canada was still intact. Their main army was still viable in New York. What changed was public opinion as far as it could be expressed in this period, mainly through Parliament, that members of Parliament were no longer willing to vote money to continue the war or to support Lord North unless he gave a guarantee that there would be a withdrawal from America. So in that sense, it's very like Afghanistan and Vietnam. The British won large proportion of the battles. They were able to take every city at some point in America, but ultimately there just wasn't the public support for continuing the war.
And it was the loss at Yorktown that finally said this was the end and what are the terms going to be?
It did, but it wasn't clear at the time that Yorktown was the end. George III said that, we shall continue. This is a setback like Saratoga. Lord North stayed in power until March of the following year. And the fighting continued, but George Washington thought that there was going to be a much larger and more major battle in New York and tried to persuade the French naval commander de Grasse to take his fleet next to New York. But really, Yorktown did signal the end for the British. They'd had great hopes that somehow Lord Cornwallis was going to work a miracle. And it had become very clear that the majority of Americans didn't support Britain and that this would just continue to be a war of attrition.
Did Britain pretty much have the say, though, as to what the terms would be for settling the American Revolution? They did lose those two colonies we mentioned earlier, East and West Florida.
So they didn't have much say about the 13 colonies. Clearly, they were going to have to concede their independence. But the Earl of Shelburne, who was the British Prime Minister who oversaw the peace treaties before they were actually signed, not only with Americans, but with the French and Spanish, he, in fact, made major concessions, especially in the Northwest. So places like Minnesota and Wisconsin and Ohio and Illinois, the British gave those to America, and that this was an area where the fighting had been far from decisive. And Shelburne's argument was that the British would be doing more trade with America after the war than it had done before the war. And it was in their interest to create goodwill in America. So he actually offered relatively lenient peace terms, too lenient according to many of his opponents, but they eventually had to sign off on them.
It's a fascinating and slightly unconventional look at the American Revolution. How necessary was it? Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy, always a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Norman. It's been my pleasure.
Look forward to our next conversation. This is University of the Year.